give you an idea of where we are and where we're going. This is what I call one of my vignette classes, where we just have the short little vignettes from the books to make sure that we're all on top of the stories, we remember the stories. Most people who are in this class have been in class for most of their lives. We've got a lot of people who have not. So I always try to put something in there. So even if you've been in Sunday school all your life and you've heard this story 18,000 times, maybe there's a little nugget extra. That's my goal anyway. This class will be followed probably by another vignette class. Now, on the Want More, a lot of you have emailed me some of your favorite stories about David. I've gotten to use some of them today. Next week, your Want More is going to be mail me your least favorite stories about David. What do you wish he hadn't done or wasn't in there? And we'll try and look at those next week or the week after. I'm preparing one of the archaeology lessons, and those take a lot of time for me. So they're 20, 30 hours of research and stuff before I even begin to write. This one is going to be on the Philistines. And what does archaeology tell us about the Philistines that helps put the biblical stories into a more full context? What do we know about the way they worshiped? Why were they such bad guys? And so we'll be looking at that. I'll try and have Steve get an email out to everybody so you'll know if it's next Sunday or the Sunday afterwards, and you can bring your shovels for the appropriate Sunday. With that, let's start with our vignettes. Vignette day means we're going to be watching TV today. Vignettes with David. David. Gets worse. So with that, we're going to start our vignettes. Now, you'll be pleased to know I did not think creatively of doing this horrible thing until about 3:15 this morning. Or I would have called Steve and said, Steve, can we change up the announcements and do them as commercials in between the episodes of our TV show? But I decided not to call him, although Steve might have been awake and probably could have juggled it there toward the end. Can you imagine we'd have had one person? So right now, that was your little promo tease, and someone comes up here, they give the announcement about the ladies' retreat, go sit back down, and we begin with episode number one. So, episode number one, and I will tell you. Okay. Sorry. You get the theme song with each episode. It's just, get used to it. But I did cut it down a little bit. Episode one is David and Samuel. It is an episode entitled Samuel's Vision Test. See, I'm acutely aware of vision tests. I was in seventh grade when I was going out for, you try out for baseball teams in the summer at that age. And when I was in seventh grade, you could either make it in the major leagues or the minor leagues. And that was the classification they gave you. And the tryouts included pitching. You know, they would throw the ball and you would hit. Well, Dad decided I was not hitting as well as I should. And it was one of several things. Either a lack of talent, which would have hurt him because that's genetics, or maybe a lack of experience, which would have hurt him because he was supposed to teach me how to play baseball. Or maybe my vision was off, but he didn't really want to go there. So it wasn't until a little bit later when I was driving with my grandfather in the oil leases around San Angelo, Texas, in Tom Green County, that my grandfather said to me, as I'm sure you've said to your seventh grade grandchildren, it's time for me to teach you how to drive. So when I was in seventh grade, my grandfather on these oil leases on these Caliche roads, there it is. He would set me behind the wheel and tell me to drive. Now the problem is they had these chug holes in the road. And he'd say, look out for that chug hole. I never saw the chug hole. So I'd hit it. And he had colorful language. It'd be about the third chug hole before the colorful language would click in. But it would click in. And at that point, I knew my driving was through for the day. And he thought that perhaps I was doing this on purpose. And I explained to him, I really wasn't trying to hit the chug holes. He says, you're hitting every hole you could possibly hit. I said, well, it's not my fault. I didn't see the hole. And so he went back and he told my parents, either your son's a liar or he's blind as a bat. You need to figure out which it is and fix it. And so Dad, that was final confirmation. So Dad took me to the eye doctor, and sure enough, I could not make out anything but the top E. I really had very, very, very poor vision. And so I got those glasses. When I got those glasses, I can remember where we were on 4th Street. Now, in the glasses shop, when the glasses came in, they tried them on to adjust them, but I took them off. And then I can remember driving home thinking, okay, I'm going to put them on. So I put those glasses on. I was 4th Street, just a little bit west of University. And I put them on, and I saw things I had never seen before from the car. I can remember going to English the next day in school and seeing things on the chalkboard that I thought there'd just been a really bad glare in there. I didn't know you could really see things that clearly. It made a world of difference how I saw things once I got those glasses. Now, I tell you that because today we're going to look at Samuel and a vision test that he had and what he had to learn from it. We pick up the story with Saul. God had pronounced that Saul would not be king forever and his lineage would not continue because Saul was disobedient to the Lord. And so Samuel is mourning this fact. And he's very sad. He's very depressed. And God says to Samuel, fill your horn with oil and go. I'm going to send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I've provided for myself a king among his sons. Well, Samuel says, this isn't going to be real cool if the king Saul finds out I'm going to anoint another person king, another man king. He'll probably kill me. That's considered treason. And God says, don't worry about it. Just go sacrifice in Bethlehem and I'll take care of the details. So Samuel goes. He goes to Bethlehem. He invites Jesse and he invites Jesse's sons to the sacrifice. And while he's there, the sons kind of parade in front of him. And the first son, Eliab, is the oldest son and evidently a tall, striking, good-looking fellow. Because Samuel's immediate reaction is, surely this is the one I'm supposed to anoint. He's got the oil. He's ready to go. And God says, no, don't look on his appearance. Don't look on his height, the height of his stature, because I've rejected him. See, the Lord sees not as a man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. And so God proceeds Samuel proceeds through God's discernment to go through each one of 7 sons. And none of them ring the bell. And so Samuel's a bit befuddled and he says to Jesse, did I get all of your sons? Did I miss something here? Jesse said, well, you got all of them except the little boy, the baby boy's out watching the goats while we do this, the sheep. He says, well, bring in a baby boy. So in comes young David. And God says, this is the one. This is the man after my own heart. This is the one I want you to anoint. And Samuel anoints David. Now, that's a great vignette. That's a great story. I'm sure it's one you've heard. But what you may not have done, and what we'll try and throw in here for a little fun, is a little Hebrew lesson. In Hebrew, there's a Hebrew word that is a yod, it's an aleph, and it's a hey. This Hebrew word is R, aleph, and hey. So that's the letter R. Aleph doesn't really correspond to an English letter, though it ultimately becomes our letter A, but it's not always pronounced as an A. So instead of writing it as an A, they write it as an apostrophe because it can take on some different sounds. And that's the letter H. That becomes our H. And because Hebrews are writing the wrong direction, or we are, for us, that is R apostrophe H. Ra'ah is the way you might pronounce it. Ra'ah. Ra'ah means to see. Now, Ra'ati means I see. So when I say Ra'a means to see, you can say Ra'ati, you see. Ra'a, to see. That word is used over and over and over in this story. So now here's your Hebrew test. I'm going to give you two of the verses. Fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided for myself a king among his sons. Got it? Here's the other verse. Do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as a man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. Now you see the word sees twice there in the translation, right? But I'm here to tell you that it's actually used six times in those verses. The Hebrew word ra'ah, to see, is used six times. So your job is to figure out where they are. Now if I had thought of this earlier, because it just now occurred to me, I'd have the da 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 da, the Jeopardy music playing for you while you do this. Da 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 da. You ready? Six times. We're going to start with the easy one. It's the bigger one. Five of them are in the big box. Five of them. Where do you think the first one is? Oh, that would have been my guess too. You're wrong. The word look is a different word that means to gaze at or to stare at. To, you know, he's just kind of enamored with it. You're just looking at, oh, okay. See, that's the word that would apply like for my daughters when they look upon Justin Bieber. It's more than just a look, a see, it's this intent gaze. Which makes no sense to me. Not saying anything negative about Justin Bieber on the internet. If you're watching this, Justin, sing on. But do not look on his appearance. Don't look upon what he sees like, how you sees him. Hey, that's almost East Texas. Don't look on how you sees him. Or on the height of his stature, because I've rejected him. For the Lord sees not as a man sees. Man looks, this time it is the same word, sees, on the outward appearance. There it's a different word for appearance. That's the word for eyes. Man looks, that's the eyes. I can see you in your eyes. But the Lord looks on the heart. The Lord looks and sees what a man truly is, not just what he looks like. All right. So those are five. Where's the other one? Fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided for myself a king among his sons. That's the first verse that started this whole journey for Samuel. That was his test. So what's the word? Provided. So where it says, God says, I have seen for myself, literally, I've seen for myself a king among his sons. Now, Samuel, you go find him and anoint him. So Samuel goes and Samuel sees, looks upon the first kid, the oldest, thinks that's him. God says, no, that's not him. You're seeing, you're looking like a man. You got to look like the Lord does. You're looking for the heart. I want a man after my own heart, not a man who looks good in pictures. And so our Hebrew lesson for this is very simple. How's your vision? How do you look at others? And how do you look at yourself? It's a dual question. The Lord doesn't see as a man sees. When I look at myself, I see every blemish and every problem I've got, physically, emotionally, spiritually, psychologically. I can look at myself in a mirror and I can find things that Becky probably could never find because I just know where to look. God doesn't see that the way I do. See, God doesn't see all of your blemishes and shortcomings as an inability for you to do what He's got you to do. When God looks at you, He made you, and He made you up for the task. Whatever you've got in front of you to do, God made you to be able to do it. And you're going to be able to. You will do it by His power and by His strength because that's what He's made you to be. So one part of this take-home message is how I see myself. Another part of this take-home message is how I see others. You know, Pastor Fleming last week talked about expectations within a marriage. Reminded us of that this morning. It's a good reminder. Because we should be looking at our spouses and others not as man does, but as the Lord does. That's your point for home. That's the end of the episode. We should have a commercial, but we don't. Instead, we go to episode 2. Would have been funny if I'd have had like a picture for Goliath from Gath, so when his name spins out, you see the picture too. But I couldn't find one that seemed adequate. Goliath, everybody, raise your hand if, okay, this would be like really awkward, so I don't expect you to, but I don't think there's anybody out there. Is there anybody out there that does not know the story of David and Goliath? Raise your hand. Okay, Steve, Taylor, anybody else? No, I mean, we all know the story. It's a great story. But there are people in the world who aren't that familiar with it. So here's the way I want to tell it to you. It was 2005. I was set to try the first Vioxx case in the nation. Now, Vioxx was a drug. The FDA, David Graham with the FDA, said that the Vioxx medication in America alone had caused an extra 80 to 120,000 heart attacks. So there were thousands, tens of thousands of lawsuits over this drug. And out of all of those lawsuits, we were going to try the very first one. By we, it's me and Dr. Bob and our team. And we're not anything too big. We work at a law firm that Kevin can tell us how many we had back then, but we didn't have but a few dozen lawyers at the time, right, Kevin? And we're up against not only an international drug company that's worth gazillions of dollars, but they have hired stable load after stable load of the thoroughbred lawyers from all around the world. They have international law firms working on this. They have dozens and dozens of lawyers. Before all was said and done, this drug company spent over $2 billion on lawyers alone. $2 billion. And we go in to try the very first case, not because we're anything special, but because the drug company figured we were the ones they could most easily beat. This wasn't an area where we'd ever tried a case before, Bob. This was our first pharmaceutical case. And they thought we didn't know what we were doing. And not only was the drug company figuring they would whip us, but a lot of the lawyers who had these other cases were worried about it as well. Because what happened to us might affect the value of their cases. So there was this one lawyer from New York who wedged his way in and decided that he was going to watch and try to help and basically get involved in what we were doing. Nice enough fella. And he came down to watch the trial. And he said, well, let me see your opening statement. And so I was giving my opening statement, not just to him, but to the rest of the team. And he got very upset because I had PowerPoint. And he said to me, he walked up to me, he's a short little guy. And he has a tendency to poke you when he talks to you. I mean, you walk away bruised if you talk to him longer than about 30 minutes. So he walks up to me and he starts poking me. He says, "Don't you do that. Don't you do that PowerPoint. You get rid of that PowerPoint. I've been trying cases for 30 years. You speak from the gut. You don't use PowerPoint. You speak from the gut." Boom, 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 boom. Well, I mean, I was letting the guy come down and watch what we were doing, but I wasn't doing it because I was nervous and needed help. I was doing it just because I'm just a boy who can't say no, and he wanted to come. So I said, "Hey, Ben, appreciate it, but not my first rodeo. I use PowerPoint when I talk. I'm going to use the PowerPoint. Thank you." So then he goes to Bob. "Tell him to get rid of the PowerPoint." He goes to Rick Meadow. "Tell him to get rid of the PowerPoint. You know, he's not doing it the way I'm telling him to. He's not listening to me." And so these people, my team, even a witness, he goes to one of my expert witnesses. "You better go tell Lanier." And so I had to sit him down. And I said, "Ben, I want to talk to you for a minute. I said, I want to tell you a story of David and Goliath. I said, now you may not believe the story, and that's fine. I'm not here to convince you it's true, but I believe it. And I live out of it, and it's part of my fiber. It keeps me going. So you need to know it just so you know what you're dealing with." And I told him the story. It's the story you know. Goliath comes out every day. For 40 days, he taunts the Israelites. "Why should our army battle your army? Why should all these men die? I'm one guy. You get your one guy. Send him on." Now, depending upon whether you read the Hebrew Masoretic text, as it's called, that places Goliath over 9 foot tall, between 9'4 and 9'9. Or if you read the Septuagint, which would have been a Greek copy made from a different line of Old Testament manuscripts, that places Goliath at about 6'9". But you figure David's was much shorter then than people are now. He's in his mid to low 5 foot range, and that's plenty giant enough. So somewhere between 6'9 and 9'9, you've got NBA quality size. And David goes to his brothers. Three of his brothers are fighting for King Saul, and he brings them some food. And David's there when Goliath comes out and gives the taunt. Now, while all of Israel's army had been cowering in fear and for 40 days been frozen into inaction, David's reaction, as one who's been filled by the Spirit of God, David's reaction is to elbow his brothers. He says, "Get a load of this idiot. What is an uncircumcised Philistine doing taunting the armies of Almighty God? Can you get a load of this guy?" And his older brother, the one that God said no, no, no on, his older brother says, "Would you quit being a spoiled little baby? You don't need to get all the attention. Just leave it alone." David says, "Well, I'm going to fight the guy if nobody else will. I mean, what's the guy get who wins this thing? Why aren't you lining up to fight?" So the word goes to the king. The king, of course, has the best of weaponry. The king says, "David, here, I'm going to put my armor on you. You can take my sword." And so all of, and remember, King Saul was a head taller than the other Israelites. So this heavy, bulky armor goes on David. And David gets King Saul's sword. And he tries to walk, and he can't even walk. And he looks at the king and says, "Hey, with all due respect, thank you very much for the armor, but I can't wear it. I have not tested it." He said, and this is a photo of the actual field where this took place. This is the mountain on one side. There's a mountain on the other. These are called mountains in Israel. We call it a dirt pile. But this is the actual valley. And so David says, I cannot go with your armor. I haven't tested it. But I will tell you this, when a bear came and got my sheep, or a lion came and got my sheep, with God Almighty, I was able to defeat him. And I'll do the same with this uncircumcised Philistine. So he takes off the armor, he sets down the sword, he goes to the brook, he picks up 5 smooth stones, and he goes out, and the rest of it's history. Now, I did not tell Ben, but I will tell you, that as he's going out there, Goliath is cursing him and cursing God. And do you know what the penalty is in Numbers in the Old Testament for cursing God, whether you're a Jew or a Gentile? You're supposed to get stoned. It happened. So David picks up the stones. He's cursing God. He gets stoned. Boom, it's over. David takes his sword, lops off his head. And I said to Ben, I said, Ben, with all due respect to what you think works in trial for you, I'm not using your weapons. I'm going to go with what I know. I'm going to go with the advisors I trust. I'm going to go with the battle plans we put together. And I'm going to fight this battle as seems right. Well, I don't know that he was ever satisfied with that, but I learned to put a buffer between me and him, and needed that buffer. Because this was a fight, but it was a fight that we took on with weapons we knew. Now, we won the case, and as a result, we got asked to go speak all over the country on how we won the case. And we spoke to lawyers who were believers and lawyers who were pagans all around the country, by thousands of lawyers. And do you know the story I got to tell all of them? The story of David and Goliath. Because I explained to them that there are different ways to fight a battle, but we chose the way that worked for us. And I said, I did that out of my conviction that there was a wise boy named David who had the Spirit of God upon him. And when he was called into a battle, he said, I've got God on my side. I'm going with the weapons I know, and God will decide who wins. That's all I need. And it was a wonderful opportunity to share that story. So I urge you to consider this as a point for home. I cannot go with these, for I've not tested them. Now, I don't know what Goliath you face in your life and whether he's 9'9" or 6'9". I don't know if he's been taunting you for 40 days or if he's just now taunted you. I don't know if you're frozen with fear. I don't know if you're waiting for someone else to come save the day. But I will tell you this. If you sign up with God and you seek God's will, His will be done. And that's really all you want, whether you realize it or not. Where I get into the most trouble in my life is where I try to substitute what I want for what He wants. I've lost cases in the courtroom that I wanted to win. But in the grand scheme of things, it's what was right before the Lord. So it's not always what I want, but it's what God wants, and that is what we want to do. So seek God's result against your giants. And if you're seeking His results, you can take the tools He's given you or tools He supplies you at the moment. But God is the tested weapon, and you will not lose if it's His results you're seeking. You with me? Okay, you getting used to this song yet? Episode 3. If you've slept through the last one, it's time to wake up. We only have 2 more episodes to go, and they're short ones. Episode 3, What Drives You? Starring David, co-starring Saul. What drives you? In the mid-20th century, there was a famous psychologist. His name was Abraham Maslow. And Maslow developed a theory for what motivates people. Why do people do what they do? I've read a bunch on his theory. And I've read some of his work on it. I didn't just read about it, but I've read some of his work. I'm convinced that there is a lot of merit to what Maslow says about what motivates people if you're dealing with unregenerate people. If you're dealing with people who do not know the Lord and walk by His Spirit, then I think Maslow really nailed something here. Here's what he says. He says, motivations are like a pyramid, and you got to start at the bottom and climb to the top. The most basic motivation are your physical needs. You need food. You need sleep. You need air. You need water. If you do not have your physical needs met, you will operate out of that motivational level. You will fight for food. You will fight for sleep. You will fight for oxygen. If you are underwater and you have no air to breathe, you will not spend the next 60 seconds drawing pictures in the water with your hand for an artistic expression. You will fight for that air. That need will trump anything else. If these physical needs are met, these core physical needs, at that point, Maslow says, you get a greater concern over your security needs. This is your safety, your freedom from fear, order in your life. But if you are, let's go back to the water example. If you have escaped, you're in the middle of born identity. Except since this is church, we'll have reborn identity. You're in the middle of the movie, and the bullets are flinging around you, and you jump over the bridge to get into the water to escape the bullets, and they're shooting down at you, but you dive deep. At some point, you're going to run out of air. You will surface to get air, even if they're still shooting, because that bottom physical need will trump the next level. But once you've got air, you'll go back down, because the freedom from fear, the security needs is that next layer. You with me? I don't mean to give you a primer in psychology, but Dr. Bob's here. He says, if you learn this stuff, this gets you at least a master's degree. Number three, your social needs. We have a need for love. We have a need for affection. We have a need to belong. But you will not motivate out of those needs unless you have already met your needs for physical insecurity. If you're worried about being alive tomorrow, it will trump your desire to get out today to be with someone. You with me? All right. Once all of those needs are met, Maslow said, you get to your esteem needs, the esteem of others, being the Aretha Franklin, R-E-S-P-E-C-T. You don't worry about respect when you're in the water fighting for air. You don't worry about respect when you're fleeing the bullets. You don't worry about respect unless you already have love. That love needs to be met, and then you look for that respect. Now, the next, the final, is self-actualization, your fulfillment of your individual abilities, your artistic expressions sometimes, your those motivations, the higher lofty motivations, are not motivations people act out of when they're still fighting for the others. Now, I think there's truth to this in the unregenerate man. I do not think there's truth like this when you're motivated by the Spirit of God. So let's look at this with Saul. Saul's having trouble sleeping. He can't sleep. These spirits, these distempers come upon him, and he just can't sleep. And someone finds David, and his music seems to soothe Saul. So David plays the harp. Saul gets his sleep, and Saul is a happy man. Now, security needs freedom from fear. Saul's sleeping well. We have no reason to think he's not, but we do know in another story that Goliath has him petrified. And Saul's the king of fear. And David comes in with his sling, kills Goliath. The Philistines are routed. And Saul's no longer afraid. Second level met. Third level, love, affection, and belonging. Saul's got a son, Jonathan. He's got other children as well. But Saul even brings David in at that point to his table and says, "You be like one of my children." Gives David his daughter, Michael, in marriage. So you've got love, affection, and belonging, and everything's fine. But if those three areas are met in the unregenerate man, at least according to Maslow, where's the next area he'll finally start to operate out of? Esteem of others. And for Saul, with David, that's a problem. Because David goes out to fight the battles Saul sends him on, and when David comes back, all of the women are singing, "Saul struck down his thousands, and David his ten thousands." Saul does not like that. And so Saul acts out of this motivation in jealousy, and he tries repeatedly to kill David because Saul so covets the esteem of others, he cannot live while David's getting it. He tries to kill David with spears. He tries to kill David over and over and over again. He tries to kill David through deceit. And the interesting, ironic thing is, the more Saul tries to kill David, the more Saul's family comes to David's aid. David's life is saved by Jonathan, the son of Saul, by Michal, the daughter of Saul. They will trick their father before they'll let their father kill David. They love him, care for him. Not only that, but David has a chance to kill Saul. But David, who has the Spirit of the Lord upon him, David doesn't worry about his physical needs. David doesn't worry about his security needs. David doesn't worry about his social needs, his esteem needs. David spares Saul's life repeatedly. Tries to bring Saul to his senses. One time, Saul's just in a cave, which is kind of like a restroom stop when you're out there at that day and age. And so Saul is in the cave relieving himself, and David happens to be in the back of the cave hiding, but manages to go cut off a corner of Saul's robe to show he could have killed Saul. Saul goes outside, he rejoins his army, and David comes to the mouth of the cave and says, "Hey, you're missing part of your robe. I could have killed you if I wanted to. Doesn't this tell you I'm not out to get your kingdom?" But Saul's concern was not simply that David was out to get his kingdom. Saul's concern was jealousy. David was getting his attention. So what's our point for home? It's really interesting, and when David is anointed by Samuel, verse 13 of chapter 16 says, "The Spirit of the Lord rushed upon David." And the very next verse says, "The Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul." See the contrast. Because with the Spirit of the Lord, things are different. Go back to that one more time. Ask yourself this: where did Jesus operate? What was his motivation when he died for you and me? Was he fighting for air, food, or sleep? No. Freedom from fear? No. Love, affection, belonging? He's all by himself. Peter even went away. No. Esteem of others? He was esteemed not, Scripture says. Jesus operated entirely out of a devotion for the greater good, for the good for you and me. That's it. I mean, that was his motivation. And so as Spirit-filled people, that needs to be our motivation as well. The problem is we're not simply Spirit-filled people. We're also people who still live in the old body. And so the question kind of becomes, which part of your life do you feed? Are you feeding the Spirit, or are you feeding the flesh? Are you trying to live out of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, faithfulness, self-control? Are you trying to live those fruits of the Spirit out of the works of the flesh with jealousy, envy, strife, anger, hostility? You know, where are you feeding? What part of you am I are we trying to nourish? That's your point. When I was in, I think I was 15 years old, I got asked to speak at a youth camp called Encounter at Lubbock Christian University. I got to give one of the evening speeches. There's like 500 or 600 people there. And I'd never done anything like that before. I'd given some speeches. I'd been in speech and done debate and all of these types of things. But in terms of public speaking to a big group, this was my first run. And I was very concerned. I'd been assigned a topic. The topic was follow me in friendship. And I didn't know what to do. And so I started thinking about it, and I was mulling it over, and my mom came to me, and she said, well, you're getting kind of close, aren't you? And I said, yeah, it's a couple weeks away. She said, have you figured out what you're going to do? I said, well, no, I'm working on it. I've got some ideas. She said, well, let me make a suggestion. I said, what's that? She said, why don't you find a Bible story that's a good story of friendship, tell the story, and then draw some parallels or some illustrations or some what we would now call points for home from it. And I thought, that's a pretty good idea. So I was working through the Bible, and I came on the story of David and Jonathan. And it was the story I told. And it's a wonderful story. It fit well. It is the story of David, who ultimately is going to be king. Jonathan even recognizes it. That there's absolutely no jealousy. Jonathan, son of King Saul, knits his soul with David. And the Hebrew word that's translated knits is literally interweaves his soul with David. And he saves David's life. And he cares for David in a genuine care, others care sense. And Jonathan says to David, one of the last times he sees David, it was set up where David's convinced Saul's trying to kill him. Jonathan's saying, Dad can't be that callous right now. David says, oh yes, I can't show up at the dinner table. Your dad's going to kill me. Jonathan says, look, I'll make up an excuse. You go hide in the woods. I'll find out if Dad's really that angry. If Dad's really going to try and kill you, then I'll come out and I'll shoot an arrow. And they set up this code system. So you'll know, flee. Well, as Jonathan's trying to figure out if Dad's that angry, Dad gets so mad at Jonathan, he tries to kill Jonathan. Jonathan's kind of like, oh, I guess he is. So Jonathan goes out, shoots the arrows, lets David know, but can't bring himself just to let David go off. So Jonathan says to his sidekick, armor bearer, whatever he'd be, says, here, take my bow and arrows and go back in. I'll be right in. Goes out with David. And they hug each other. He says to David, he said, I want you to promise me something. I want you to promise me you'll take care of my family. And David says, okay. Well, ultimately, they don't see each other that we know of again after that. Jonathan dies in battle the same day his father dies, King Saul dies, and same day his brother dies. But he's got a 5-year-old son who's lame in his feet, has trouble with his feet, named Mephibosheth. And his 5-year-old son is ushered off by some nurses because they, you know, new king on the block. So David is anointed king by some of the people. Saul's general anoints one of Saul's only remaining son as king. There's a civil war. Finally, David wins the civil war. David says, is there nobody left from the house of Saul? And someone says, hey, remember your old friend Jonathan? He had a lame son who's still alive, Mephibosheth. We call him Meph for short. Meph is still alive. David says, get him, bring him in. And David, let's see if it comes up. It doesn't. Okay. David says to Meph, he says, look, I'm restoring all of Saul's lands, all of his belongings to you. I want you to dine at my table, not because you've done anything to earn it, but because of your father and my friendship with him. There's some misunderstandings later on and some things, but this is what happens. And Meph stays with King David at his table and dines with him and lives his life with him. And so here's your point for home. My brother Jonathan, I don't know if you've got a friend. Bill and I were talking about this, and Bill Young said to me, he says, you know, the problem with friendship in our day is so many of us try to find value by tearing others down. See, we get self-esteem if other people are esteemed less instead of trying to build other people up. And it's the same principle that's in marriage. If it's one against the other, it goes down. If it's one building the other up and competing to see who can better build and help the other, the sky's the limit. So do you have a friend like that? Here's your point for home. If you have a friend like that, or if you don't, then try to find one. Try to be one. And if you've got friends like that in your life, I want you to find a chance today or this week to tell them, thank you for being my friend. And thank the Lord for them, because those friendships are rare. Now, those are our vignettes. As I said, if you want more, then for next week, if you would read 2 Samuel and email me your three least favorite things about David. I have to say three because he commits adultery with Bathsheba, and everybody can write that to me. So you got to come up with something beyond that, okay? Then we'll see if we can plug those in. Would you pray with me? Lord, I just pray your blessings upon us. I pray that those who are searching for a friend in life, you will put a friend in their way so that they have a godly person in their life to love them and speak truth to them. And I pray that they'll be friends and look to be friends with everybody. True, caring friends who operate out of your spirit and not out of the flesh, who are motivated by what's right from you. Lord, I know we've got a lot of people with problems and giants, and I pray that you will give them the confidence to trust you in those battles and to seek your will. And I thank you so much that you've filled all of us with your spirit as we believe and put our faith in you. We love you very much, and we pray through our Lord Jesus. Amen.